Love is toxic to our kind. It destroys us. I've seen it happen. Never again. I shake my head, confused. This is utterly incomprehensible. Utterly unlike the Granita I knew aboard the Pygmalion, who was about as volatile as a uranium ingot. I should know. She courted me for months. What's gotten into her? She inhales, then tenses as she speaks. This is an instruction, Kate. You must not speak to anyone about what I'm going to tell you here. Once we embark, it is likely that our conversations will be monitored. When we arrive, we will definitely be monitored. We won't be safe until we return here, and even then there may be spies, or worse, within my household. She gives me a meaning-laden look. Do you understand? There are spies here? Let me root them out, I offer, eager to redeem myself. I can lure them. It's the opening I've been looking for, the mission to offer at her feet for the sake of my own peace of mind. No, she says firmly, looking almost spooked. Conducting a purge would be just as much of a giveaway as talking in front of eavesdroppers. I've got something else in mind for you to do when we arrive. Where? I can't help myself. I need to know what I can do for her. We're going to Iris, says Granita, just as matter-of-fact as if she'd announced we were going to visit a gambling casino on Ganymede or a sulfur mine on Io. Iris? I echo stupidly. Yes, Iris. Where they build starships and harbour black laboratories, nicely outside the reach of the pink police, don't you think? I'm going there to participate in an auction, and you're coming along because I need someone I can trust at my back. A shock transfixes me. She wants me. I'm flustered but happy. What do you want me to do? Several things. She smiles now, as dry as the mummies in the Martian desert. The auction is being run by a consortium of black labs, led by an individual or lineage known as Dr. Sleepless. I don't know precisely who they are, nobody does, but what they're offering is nearly priceless. They claim to have a working creator and a support kit that will keep it alive. They built it out there in the freezing cold among the forbidden cities. It's not a one-off. If they can do it once, they can do it again. But it's unique right now, and that's a precious commodity. I'm going out there to work with, to meet some fellow investors. If possible, we're going to acquire the creature. She stops smiling. There will be other bidders at the auction. Other factions who want to obtain the creator, including, if I am not mistaken, your former employers. Don't look so shocked. Jeeves is nothing if not mendacious. What kind of butler can he be without a master to serve? But that's not important. What you'll need to know is we're not going to wait for the auction. There'll be a viewing beforehand, and that's when things will most likely turn messy. So I need someone I can trust. Someone like you. To control the creator. Me? I squeak. A creator? My dead love? Undead? Yes. She reaches out and takes my hand. You're one of Rhea's get, and unspoiled at that. You've met Pete, but you didn't imprint on him fully. Your love is a second-hand thing. You'll imprint on Dr. Sleepless's creator easily enough, but you've got some resistance. You'll obey my instructions. They won't know what you are. You're disguised well enough, but you've got the necessary skills to control a creator male. She strokes a fingertip across the back of my wrist. For an electrifying moment, I can see the naked hunger in her eyes, hunger for him, who she proposes to give to me. But, I'm speechless. What if it's female? Or not interested in me? My allies have a contingency plan for that. She squeezes my hand reassuringly. But I don't expect the Black Labs to sell a female replicator. They aren't idiots. She pats the seat cushion beside her thigh, and I slide closer, attentive. In any case, as I said, things will get messy. I don't intend to leave the other factions behind to stab me in the back, and I need to know that the Creator is in reliable hands. Hands that will manage him exactly as I would myself, without any need for me to be a shuddering breath in love. Wow, I say faintly. I lean against her shoulder, dizzy with need. The mere thought of what she wants me to do has me in a whirl of delicious anticipation. And I thought I wanted Petruchio? I ask myself. She slips an arm around me. I barely notice. How much of your Block 2 reflex set did you acquire from that soul chip before you got here? She whispers softly in my ear. 15 months, wasn't it? My reflexes? I frown. It's like a wake-up call, dragging me back from the brink of delirium. Yes, about that. I was in slow time for most of it. That won't have stopped the reflex loops imprinting. Do you know how to wire up a string of charges to blow down a building? Infiltrate a killing zone and turn the tables on your enemies? Can you kill with your bare hands? I'm not sure, I say slowly, leaning against her. I have a strange, unpleasant sense that if she hadn't stamped the seal of her ownership on my soul, I would be able to. I can almost taste the hot, quivering rage of that other, potential me that is chained in the back of my head. Kill her, whom I adore. I think maybe... Who do you have in mind? You'll see. I can feel her tongue trailing across my earlobe, but not yet. She's melting against me, and alarm bells are ringing in the distance. I feel hot and cold, transfixed simultaneously by aroused anticipation and something else, a sure, creeping certainty. You may kiss me now, Kate. If you want to. I turn my face slowly, working around the smooth velvet of her cheek until I can taste her lips. I find myself buoyed up by her barely controlled lust. It's an enormous relief to be needed again. And the wash of physical arousal as she slowly works at the fastenings on my clothes leaves me blissed out and happy for the first time since I arrived on this creator-forsaken snowball. But as she gently pushes me back onto the circular bench beneath the pitiless, unwinking stars, a nasty virus of doubt delivers its payload. I'm not sure when I first became aware of it. But I'm certain of it now. This rich and terrible aristocrat, sharp-tongued and cynical, is not the same as the one who cringed for my orders in the owner's stateroom of the Pygmalion. Granita Ford may have bankrupted my corporate self and stamped her ownership upon my helpless brain. But the woman in my arms, who wears her face and occupies her estate, is someone else. Revising my opinions. The next day, Granita is away from her palace. And the day after that, she's back. But nothing is said of what happened between us in the observation dome. It's as if it never happened. I can't say I'm surprised. It's a not uncommon morning after reaction. But I'm slightly hurt after the whispered endearments of the night before. I still bear the bite marks and aches of her engagement, although they're fading fast. I've got nothing officially to do, and how do you practice to control a creator anyway? But there's a well-equipped gym in one of the basement levels, and among its facilities there's a cell with a plentiful supply of zombies to slaughter. I make frequent use of it, working myself into near exhaustion to the point where I have to visit the in-house repair shop. But after 3 days of workouts, I can be sure that Juliet's reflexes have implanted themselves in me. It's almost spooky, as I find myself responding to half-glimpsed movements with reactions I wasn't aware of. I have to be careful when I venture into the public halls, where Granita's cadre of arthlickers hold their indolent court. Speaking of Juliet, I find myself dreaming of her all the time now. Mostly it's the usual. Flashbacks and incoherent memories of the more exciting and unpleasant incidents in her life, which was busy enough for an entire lineage. But sometimes it's as if I'm sitting beside a heavy curtain, and she's just on the other side, and I'm listening to her talking. I've got the oddest feeling that she can see through the curtain and knows what's happening to me, as if the traffic in memories runs both ways. Probably it's meaningless. I wore her soul chip for long enough that I've picked up more of her inner voice than is normally the case with my dead sibs. That, and the fact that she didn't, in fact, kill herself, leaves me with a much more vivid impression of her presence than usual. On my sixth night in Granita's palace, lying alone, for my mistress hasn't taken me to bed since our assignation in the observation dome, I can almost hear her pacing up and down beside me. "You're an idiot, Freya. It's the oldest trick in the book. Why did you fall for it?" I try to protest. "It's not my fault. She got to the local Jeeves before I did. And who else was I to go to? I had my orders." She snorts. "She got to Reginald, you mean, because she had inside information. You're the one without the excuse, sis. Who do you think ordered you to go see Reginald? Himself, who nailed me and nailed Reggie. Why do you think he ordered you to kill Reggie? To distract you? Or failing that, if you succeeded, to stop you from asking him what's really going on? It's a setup, and you walked right into it. And now you're an arbiter." "It's not so bad," I venture timidly. "I mean, it's not as if I've been handed a shovel and told to stop thinking. The fuck it isn't." Her contempt is fierce. "You're a slave, kid. A slave in aristocrature is still a slave. Nobody else can push you around, but you're going to stay a slave until you manage to lose that chip. And as long as she can make you punch yourself in the face or fuck her or cut your own breasts off if she hands you a knife and tells you what to do, you're a robot slave. And you know what she's planning for you? She's going to hand you to a creator. And then you'll really be a slave. Two times over. He'll make you imprint on him, and at the same time she'll be able to tell you what to do. And you'll never be free." Freedom? The word tastes bitter. What's freedom ever done for me? Seems to me I've been free almost all my life, but what has it gotten me? Really? She's silent for only a moment. "Ask not what it's gotten you, kid. Ask what it's saved you from." I know what I ought to be feeling right now. I ought to be feeling bleak, existential despair at my degraded predicament. I ought to be climbing the walls and rattling the bars. But she told me not to. And now I can't get worked up about it. Unless this imaginary nocturnal dialogue with a sister who isn't here is my cunning way of resolving my inner conflict. When I first met the Domina on Venus, I was thinking about ending it all, I remind her. Were you, fuck? I call you liar, Freya. You and I have both made it through 140 years. You know what the sanity decay curve is? Those of us who are going to go usually check out in the first 60 years. You're more than 2 half-lives past the suicide peak. But the soul chips get mailed around the sisterhood in sequence. And you're one of the youngest. You're at the bottom of the poll. Last in the queue. You really are fucking clueless, aren't you? She stops for a while, and I'm trying to get an angry rejoinder together when she starts up again. It's not your fault. I think we overprotected you, youngsters. Between that and what happened to Rhea when they started working on the Block 3 template, it's a wonder any of you survived. Rhea? I echo stupidly. Ha! Did you think you graduated when that asshole Jeeves slipped you a magic pill to turn you into a mutant sex bot assassin? She sounds amused now. Emma, treacherous bitch. She should have known better than to load Rhea's offcuts. Block 2's poisonous enough, as you've discovered. As lowly, borderline, unemployable sex robots, we were mostly beneath notice. But once some of the sisterhood started cropping up in the wrong places, usually clutching a severed head in one hand and a knife in the other, we came into some demand. But they didn't stop training Rhea at just 2 snapshots. That's how they faked the soul chip with the suicide memories. They took a copy of her, slapped a slave override on it, and told her to get miserable. Meanwhile, our real template matriarch was somewhere else entirely. And you'd better believe that those upgrade chips are pure nightmare. But where am I getting this stuff from, part of me wonders. I'm not usually this wildly imaginative. The rest of me is just plain indignant. We were born to be courtesans and helpmeets, not assassins. Who did this to us? Nobody, Juliet says sadly. We did it to ourselves. All because of that birthday. Or rather, Rhea's doing it to us. She's still out there. Sudden light and noise. I ping back into consciousness, raising an arm to block the glare out of my 2 wide eyes. What is the meaning of this? I demand, pushing myself up on one arm. Time to rise and shine, Big Slow. I look down at the munchkin shape in the doorway. Her bossness wants you to ready to rock and stroll in 30 minutes. We dance at dawn. Oh, I bite back on a Julietism. It wouldn't be in character. Attend to my luggage, minion. I'll be ready in my own time, I drawl imperiously, or perhaps just snottily, as Bill or Ben waits in the doorway. It wouldn't do to look excited, even though I'm all a-jitter with anticipation. The game's afoot. The name of the game in space travel is always hurry up and wait. And this trip is to be no different, at least for the first few hours. But our destination, Eris, is more than 10 times as far as anywhere I've traveled to before. So I'm wondering just how bad this trip is going to be while I do the waiting thing. Arbiters herd me back up to the reception suite, then into a large shuttle, along with my luggage, whether recovered from the hotel or cloned on the spot, I can't tell. Bill and Ben, and how did Granita contrive to get them here? That's another interesting question. And finally, Granita herself, accompanied by 6 small and vicious courtiers. They make polite small talk and quaff cocktails beneath her aloof gaze while the shuttle climbs toward orbit at 0.5 G. Luckily, they don't seem terribly interested in me. I'm not their patron. for which I'm profoundly thankful, because my supply of small talk has been depleted by Granita's pointed coolness, and if one of them got on my nerves, I'd be likely to cut them dead, literally rather than figuratively. Space travel is... No, I've already said it. But after a couple of hours of boredom, there comes an announcement. Please return to your seats and stow any loose items. We will be docking with the Icarus Express in just over 10 minutes' time. Stewards will escort you to your accommodation after arrival. Good, I think, strapping myself into the seat behind Granita to await the show. I wonder what it's going to be like. Couldn't be any worse than the Indefatigable. Granita is, of course, the first to be escorted out of the shuttle passenger compartment, followed by her dwarfish flappers. Finally, a small, space-adapted arbiter of indeterminate design comes for me. The Honourable Catherine Sorico, pleased to come this way? Of course. I untangle myself from the seat webbing and follow the arbiter, hand over hand, along the grab bars. It's not until we traverse the airlock and enter the ship's service core that I begin to realize just how wrong I've been. Hey, what's this?
This is your compartment, says the arbiter, opening a hatch at the upper end of a red-lit cell approximately the size of a coffin, if coffins stood on end and came with built-in seats. First-class accommodation. Create a normal size, please, to get in.
Hey! I'm aghast. That's not first class. Where's Granita? This is ridiculous. Kate? Get in. I look round. Granita is right behind me. In fact, she's inside a nearly identical cell.
That's an order. I'm travelling this way too.
But even as I say it, I'm lowering myself feet first into the oubliette. Why? Because we want to get there in something less than 30 years. She grimaces. Did you think the outer system was small enough to just zip around like Mercury Mars? Oh, I say faintly. My feet touch the bottom of the cell, and sticky tongues wrap themselves around my ankles. Shit. The lid winds shut on top of me. And those are the last words I exchange directly with anybody other than Icarus for the next 3.5 years.
Greetings, Honourable Catherine Sorico, says an impersonal male voice that I'm going to become excessively, tiresomely familiar with. I'm Icarus, your pilot. Welcome aboard. We will be departing from Callisto orbit within the next 2 hours, and shortly afterward there will be a period of high acceleration. Please relax, allow me to plug you into the acceleration support system, and refrain from entering slow time until I notify you that it is safe to do so.
The coffin begins to tilt around me, wheeling until my rotation sense tells me I'm lying on my back with my legs in the air. What's going on? I ask, trying not to panic as straps descend from what is now the ceiling and wrap around me, locking my limbs and torso in position.
I'm securing you. Please don't struggle. Have you travelled in a high-G cocoon before? If so, this will be familiar. Open wide.
A questing tentacle inches up around my throat and nudges at my mouth.
I won't hurt you, Icarus says a little tetchily. If you're not properly padded when I start accelerating, you may be damaged.
Ugh! I try to surrender to the inevitable, but there's a problem. Granita's instructions. Unlike my encounter with Lindy, I'm not allowed to let go and enjoy it. I feel grotesquely, unpleasantly invaded. Maybe this is what space travel is like for other folks. In which case, it's no wonder our creators never went any further than Mars. Syrupy liquid begins to flood the coffin around me.
Keep ventilating, Icarus says, as I choke around the throbbing organ he's rammed past my tonsils. You need to draw as much of this liquid as possible into your gas exchangers.
Oh, great. Now I'm going to drown, I hear myself think/say,
as speech suddenly comes back to me. No, you're not. I just hooked up your speech driver, by the way, Icarus tells me. Are you all right?
I twitch.
No, I think unhappily.
Is this really necessary?
Only if you don't care whether you survive a 60G burn.
I feel fluid oozing into my abdominal service bay.
Good. We'll have you pressurized soon enough.
What's it like in second class? I ask, trying to distract myself.
A bit tight. I had to stack the quartiers carefully. Madame Ford seems to travel with rather a large entourage.
Large? By Arista standards, it's vanishingly small. Why so? I ask, innocently.
The auxiliary speech driver is beginning to feel more natural, at least in comparison with the overall experience, which isn't saying much.
It seems large when you consider she's paying 9,000 reals per kilogram for shipping.
I try to blink, but somewhere along the way he slid tiny probes around the back of my eyeballs and my ocular motors are paralyzed.
You mean she's paying you more than $500,000 for a tentacle rape bondage scene?
I'm clearly in the wrong line of work.
No. She's paying me more than $500,000 to deliver you to Eris alive. Now, if you'll excuse me for a few minutes, I've got a nuclear rocket to supervise.
I've been floating alone and immobilized in my cell for hours, when my vision flickers to black for a moment, then comes back, showing an external view. I gasp, or I would if I could move any of my actuators, as I see Icarus Express for the first time. He's spliced the passenger's viewpoint into an external observation satellite to give us a ringside view of our own departure. He's a big ship, with the familiar structure of a magsail balanced on his snout, but my built-in sense of scale tells me that his payload pod is tiny, a drum about 5 meters high and 5 meters in diameter, perched atop some intricate machinery, then a long, cylindrical tank. Callisto is a huge, curving hemisphere of darkness beneath him. Jupiter rides gibbous and orange overhead. Past the tank, there's some kind of shielding arrangement, a long pipe, and finally something that looks like a rocket nozzle. I swear the thing's glowing.
Attention, passengers! It's Icarus. We're about to get underway, and you should all be locked down by now, if not, tough. Prompt criticality will commence in 5 seconds, and 4, 3, 2...
Have you ever seen a nuclear explosion close up? In vacuum, so it glows eerily ultraviolet with a spangling of soft X-rays, and it's so pinprick star bright in the optical range that it's like someone's torn a hole in the universe to let the Big Bang in? Now imagine that the nuclear explosion is going that away, directly aft from the nozzle at the back of the ship. It's like a laser straight bolt of lightning, growing out from the nozzle at a goodly fraction of the speed of light, and it's so bright, it splits the universe in two. Icarus launches on the back blast of a nuclear saltwater rocket. It's a flashy, dangerous, and insanely powerful fission motor, effectively a liquid-fueled reactor meltdown. At full thrust, it's pumping out more energy than every power plant on Callisto, and if a fuel pump jams, the resulting explosion will scatter us halfway to Neptune. But Icarus knows what he's doing. Nothing malfunctions. And moments after the torch ignites, the Icarus Express is dwindling into the distance.
20 G's. Throttle stable at 30%. Everything looking good. Throttle up to 90%.
I don't feel much. Just a hollow, rumbling vibration and a huge surge. I know that if my eyes were still working, they'd be blurring beneath the weight of their own lenses, and if Icarus hadn't stuffed me like a chicken... Why are chickens stuffed, anyway? I'd be a puddle all over the rare bulkhead. But he's done his job well. 500,000 reals, just for a ticket to Eris that takes less than 10 years.
I think, and try not to giggle with fear. 500 gigawatts of prompt criticality is burning a hole in space behind me. Kilograms of weapons-grade uranium solution blasted into plasma, the equivalent of a megaton explosion every 2.5 hours, and all because Granita wants to get her hands on a deadly piece of archaic replicator technology that could enslave half the solar system. Why couldn't they just hold the auction over the net, I wonder? Then I think about the cost of putting in an appearance in person. Well, I suppose it keeps the riffraff out. After about 2 minutes, the vibration dies away. The line of light stretching across the starscape dims and fades, diffusing like mist. Then my vision blanks again, and returns as a view from the rear of the Icarus Express. Jupiter bulks just as large as ever, but Callisto has begun to show more of a curvy horizon, and over the next half hour it shrinks visibly until it's no more than a large disk. I'm bored and extremely uncomfortable, and I want to move around. Eventually, I try to electrospeak. What happens now? I ask. I'll be with you in a few minutes. Icarus refuses to be hurried. When he comes back, after a seeming eternity, I tense in anticipation. Madame Sorico, sorry to leave you. I had some post-burn checks to complete. The good news is we're now on track for orbital departure. We're going to make a closer flyby of Jupiter in about 4 hours, and another burn, then we just drop right back into the inner system. The inner system? I can hear my voice rising. I thought we were going to Eris. We are, if you'll pay attention. Patronizing junk heap. I keep my speaker shut down. You know how far away Eris is? It's currently twice as far out as Pluto. My main motor is very powerful, but I have to conserve fuel so we can slow down at the other end. If I did a direct burn and decelerate, it'd take us about 18 years to get there. But there's a shortcut available. You may have noticed I'm carrying a mag sail. We're carrying out a brief burn and a close Jupiter flyby to cancel out our orbital velocity around the sun. If we're not in orbit, we fall. And in this case, we fall all the way back down the solar gravity well until we're inside the orbit of Mercury. Then we spread the mag sail and accelerate up to cruise speed for Eris and arrive with about 80% of our fuel still available for deceleration. But isn't that in the wrong direction? I ask. Nope. And now he sounds really smug. Jupiter and Eris are close to opposition right now. The sun is right between them. So we're actually following the shortest path between the two worlds.